Accession number 13935, Reel 1.
Saturday, June the 23rd, 1944, started the same as any other day. I woke tired to the familiar patter of rain on canvas. After days of rain, I dug a circular slit trench around the outside of my tent to drain the water away. But this had filled during the night and was now overflowing into stall tributaries, turning the floor of the tent into a carpet of mud. Everything inside the tent was damp, particularly bedclothes and clothes. Bambi, my navigator, had caught a hacking cough, but refused to see the doctor. With the losses since D-Day, the wing was very short of crews. On the way to lunch, I fell in with my flight commander, with the flight commander of 21 Squadron, who said, "You're in luck, Peter. The GH aircraft are all operational, and the group wants to put three aircraft onto the Cherbourg Peninsula tonight. You'd better air test your aircraft this afternoon. You're a jammy sod. You'll probably get away with only one sortie tonight." Bambi and I spent most of the afternoon on an airborne check of the GH equipment in Tifa Tommy. We had lost a starboard engine from light flak a few days previously, so we gave the new one a very thorough run-up and check. As we were not on target until 23 hours, we spent a leisurely early evening reading the papers and lingering over supper in the mess tent. At 2100 hours, the three crews on the GH detail were briefed separately on the military situation, weather, flak positions, entry and exit corridors, call signs, etc. The US forces, having broken out of their bridgehead, were pressing towards a vital part of Cherbourg, without which the whole Allied advance would be in jeopardy, denied the necessary supplies and reinforcements. The 7th U.S. Corps commenced the attack on the port itself the previous day, but had bypassed the dominating fortifications of Saint-Sauveur. They had therefore requested a bombing attack on Saint-Sauveur prior to an assault at 23:30 hours. For a change, the weather over the target was good. A break before an intense depression building up in the Atlantic moved into the area in the following 24 hours. The 3GH aircraft were to bomb at 10-minute intervals, but in the event of any delay, no bombs were to be released after 23-25 hours. Wing Commander Blacksmith, the CO of 464 Squadron, was in the briefing tent at the time, and had previously been on night fighters. He came up to me and remarked, "I know it's difficult, but try to keep an eye open for night fighters, because if they get into your area, you will be a sitting duck." Following the main briefing, we returned to the squadron dispersal as the evening closed in. Already around the airfield, engines were coughing into life as the night war in the air got underway. We changed into flying suits, collected parachutes and Mae West before going into the flight commander's office to sign the authorization book, which gave the bare outlines of the sortie. Blackjack 34, GH 20,000 feet, 4 × 500-pound bombs, time on target 2300 hours. Joe Bodian, the flight commander, initialed the detail and gave the final word. "Once you've bombed, go into a steep diving turn, down to the deck and back out as fast as you can. If you have any trouble, don't block the runway here. Go on to RAF Manston. Peter, you should know the form by now. Any questions? We walked out to the aircraft, and with only one sortie to complete, there was plenty of time to settle down and go through our drills methodically. My ground crew were grouped around Tifa Tommy, and I could make out my crew chief, Corporal Benson. Everything okay, Benson? Fine, sir. No snags at all. Aircrew have strong feelings about flying their own aircraft and would rather take it with quite a lot of unservice abilities if it meant changing to a strange one. Each aircraft seemed to have its own personality and quirks. Now and again you came up against a rogue and avoided it like the plague. I'd flown Tifa Tommy for some time and felt very familiar and at home with it. It had taken some stick, but held together well. While Bambi disappeared into the Bombay with the armourer to check and arm the bombs, I inspected the outside of the aircraft with my torch. Tires okay, all panels secured, windscreen clean. I had often jerked into a sharp turn at the side of a fighter, which turned out to be only a speck of dirt on the windscreen. We finally climbed into the aircraft through the small hatch on the starboard side of the aircraft, myself first and then Bambi. We strapped ourselves in, feeling our way around the cockpit, using as little light as possible to preserve night vision. Finally, Benson closed the hatch with a cheery, "Good luck, sir, and please don't bring back any work tonight." After the pre-start checks, I flashed my torch through the side panel, and on getting the all-clear signal, stabbed the engine buttons. The two Merlins caught easily and were soon throbbing rhythmatically. The Merlins are inclined to overheat on the ground and have to be immersed along until opening up for takeoff. I waved the chocks away with my torch, and by the time I reached the end of the runway, had already completed the takeoff checks. I stopped only briefly, flicked navigation lights on and off for takeoff. Strict radio discipline was now in force to avoid giving the listening enemy any clues about our operations. Received an immediate green Aldous lamp from the runway caravan in return and lined up on the runway. It is always at this point, staring into the inky blackness ahead, that my stomach turns over like a boxer first entering the ring before the fight starts. Once I get down to work, then it's all right again. Slowly and carefully, I ease the throttles forward, keeping straight down the narrow funnel of dim runway lights, using rudder and differential throttle. As full power was poured on, the Mosquito accelerated rapidly, and by 80 miles an hour, as the flying controls began to bite, you could begin to feel you had an aircraft strapped on. 100 miles an hour, 110, 120, 130, back on the stick, harder back, and then with a final jerk, Tifa Tommy came unstuck, and with a full load lurched into the darkness. Thorny Island is almost surrounded by estuary, and I was conscious of the water rushing only a few feet below. I nursed the aircraft into a climb, and once a positive altimeter reading had been established, raised the undercarriage. Now clear, the Mosquito began to build up speed rapidly and climb away, and I could settle down to instrument flying. Bambi passed me a course to fly and an altitude to reach, and for once was not sick. I saw him out of the corner of my eye stick a piece of gum into his mouth and chew away contentedly as he began to pore over his G-charts. It took about 20 minutes to climb to 20,000 feet, carefully checking radiator temperatures every few thousand feet to get the maximum rate of climb without overheating the engines. The Merlins were purring beautifully with no sign of trouble from the starboard engine. and the exhaust stubs glowed comfortably red in the dark. I turned the cockpit lights right down until only the luminous outline of the flickering needle showed, and we came a shadow stalking down a dark starlit lane towards the Cherbourg Peninsula. Finally, Bambi broke the silence. Okay, Peter, I picked up the lattice line and we can follow it onto the target. This was a dangerous time. With small changes of course at a constant height, with pilot concentrated on instruments and the navigator with his eyes firmly glued into the visor of the GH equipment, we were an easy prey for night fighters. Left 2 degrees, left 1 degree, left another, steady, and so on, with Bambi faithfully following the signals on his scope. 2 minutes to the outer marker, Bambi continued. I looked up from the instruments momentarily to catch the flash of guns marking the American advance down the peninsula, and then bowed my head again in concentration. Since 1 degree off course, 100 feet out on height, could make a difference of 100 yards in bombing accuracy. Outer marker, settle down on 129 degrees, steady, final bob heading 125, check airspeed 240 miles an hour, height 20,000 feet. Bambi's smooth and efficient patter ran on. 1 degree left, steady, 1 minute to go, bomb selected and fused, bomb doors open now. The bomb doors opened with a rumbling sound, and flying with them open was like driving a car over cobblestones. I had to open the throttles to keep the speed steady at 240 miles an hour. 30 seconds to go, 125 degrees, steady. I could detect the rising excitement in Bambi's voice. In a marker, keep steady, 125, steady, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, release, bomb's gone. The aircraft bucked and tossed. I snapped the bomb doors closed, threw the aircraft into a spiraling dive towards home. Course 300 degrees and down to 1,000 feet, Peter, said Bambi in a more normal voice. The airspeed indicator came alive. 260 miles an hour, 280 miles an hour, 300 miles an hour. But suddenly the darkness outside was split by shafts of light like illuminated stair rods. Christ, what the bloody hell! And then wham, wham, wham. The aircraft shuddered violently as though halted in its flight by a shower of large rockets. The control column was wrenched out of my hands, and simultaneously the instrument shattered as the cockpit filled with acrid smoke. Recovering from the initial shock, I grabbed at the controller column. Quick, Bambi, we've been hit. And give me a course to keep us over land. Watch your damage. No answer. And out of the corner of one eye, I could see Bambi still leaning over his G-box. The Mosquito was a side-by-side two-seater, with the navigator slightly set back in an unarmored position, while my own back and head were protected by a shield of hardened steel. A sheet of flame spread over the starboard engine, whose temperature gauge had now run off the clock. I had no alternative but to stab the feathering button. My only concern now was with the aeroplane and the extent of its wounds. I pulled back on the control column, but there was little response, as it flapped loosely in my hands. Almost at the same time, if indeed there is any sequence to the death struggles of Tifa Tommy, a trail of spark shot out of the port engine, followed by a loud explosion. Automatically, I stabbed the port feathering button. The aircraft continued its spiraling path downwards. I could make out the rigid propellers in the glare from the burning engines. And with the Merlin silenced, all that I could hear was a rush of air outside and the thuds as the engines disintegrated from the intense heat. I knew beyond doubt that the engine was near and there was nothing left to fly with. My whole mind and training switched to the urgent necessity of getting Bambi and myself out of what now was only a burning coffin. Bail out, Bambi, get the jaw desiccated, I yelled. There was no answer, no movement from my navigator. For Christ's sake, Bambi, get the bloody door open. The so-called door was a narrow hatch on the navigator's side, which was just large enough to squeeze through, and I knew it would have to be opened, and Bambi got through it before I myself could exit. There was no other way. I grabbed Bambi's arms and pushed him forward on the floor, where now my navigator showed some signs of life, fumbling with the emergency handle. Mayday, 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 Blackjack 34, bailing out. No reply, but then, clear as a bell, this is Gordon Cummings, Peter. Can I help? I'm over the Cherbourg Peninsula. Gordon Cummings was the pilot of the aircraft immediately behind mine on the GH detail. No, Gordon, we're in real trouble, bailing out, and I'm going on to a steady transmit, so try to get someone to get a fix on us. Suddenly the door blew off, and the cockpit filled with a blast of cold air. Against the fire in the starboard engine, I could now make out Bambi, clearly crouched down on the floor, and I'd no time to find out whether the red shadows on the back of his flying suit were from the engine on fire or some dreadful wound. Bail out, I shouted. There was still no answer. I unstrapped, got down on the floor, and swearing began pushing Bambi through the hatch. My whole urgent instinct was now to get clear myself. And then suddenly Bambi popped out. 1 minute he was there, and the next gone. But for 1 second I saw his white face and eyes, which showed no fear. I now knelt in the doorway and pushed myself outwards against the solid walls of air. The whole engine and underneath of the nacelle was illuminated by fire, and I could feel the searing heat. With one Herculean effort, I was out and tumbling away from the burning aeroplane. There was no sensation of falling, and I came hypnotized by the peace and silence around me after the noise and shambles of the cockpit. I suddenly realized I had to deploy my parachute, searched and scratched desperately for the D-ring, found it and tugged it violently. There was a great jerk, followed by the tearing noise of the shrouds as they protested the speed at which I was travelling through the air, placing an almost unbearable strain on the cords and panels of chute. However, it held together, and I felt it gradually stabilising my descent. The night was black, although I could just make out the white roof of the parachute over my head. A bright explosion not far away showed where T for Tommy hit the water, and in the short life of the burning wreckage on the sea, I could just estimate that I still had about 2,000 feet to fall before the light was extinguished and the blackness closed in. I reached for my torch, normally tucked into one of my flying boots, only to find that both boots had been wrenched off by the force of the slipstream as I left the aircraft, and the torch had gone with them. This was a bad blow, but worse was to follow. Just as I was preparing to inflate my Mae West life jacket, I hit the sea and went under. The shock of cold water and the first choking mouthful of sea woke me to the stark reality of the situation, and a new struggle began in earnest. I grasped at the handle of my Mae West, found it and pulled it. I could hear the gas escaping and felt the bladders of the waistcoat expanding and gripping my body like a tight corset. It brought me to the surface, gasping and spluttering. At first, I thought I had surfaced under a low white cloud, but quickly realized the parachute canopy had collapsed over me. I was in the middle of an air pocket underneath it. I released the harness and tried to push my way clear, but the cords had tangled around my legs, and as the shrouds became sodden with water, So the parachute began to sink and pull me down with it. I began to struggle and swallowed more seawater. Panic overcame me, and I fought to free myself. The more I fought, the more water I swallowed. Suddenly I realized that I was going to drown. Reason returned and my mind began to function logically. You are drowning because you are panicking. First, stop panicking. I did and felt more relaxed. Then I thought, now you've got to get clear of the shrouds. I began to feel and locate the cords binding me to the canopy like a giant weed. I remember the clasp knife in my flying suit and find it, began to cut the cords away one by one, ducking my head below the sea, finding a cord and sawing through it, coming up for air and then going down again. How long this went on for, I cannot tell. It seemed like a long time before the last strand was parted, and exhausted, I floated free. For a while, I lay riding the waves in my Mayweather. But the will to survive returned, and I began to think about the dinghy attached to my May West on a long lead. I found the lead and had soon gripped the pack. Methodically, I undid the press studs around the canvas cover, pulled out the rubber innards, then slowly felt around its periphery until I located the air bottle. The air went in with a hissing rush, filling the rubber walls, which grew with every second. Silence at last, and the dinghy was inflated. It required all my remaining strength to climb onto the dinghy, where I lay across it, only half conscious, my cheek pressed against the bulging side. My thoughts were only of the rapid and devastating transposition from the familiar surroundings of my aeroplane returning to base, and the unreality of this ice-cold, wet, hostile world that I now found myself in. I had no idea what had happened to my navigator. In a mosquito, the pilot sits on his parachute and dinghy pack, which are already firmly strapped to his body, whereas the navigator's parachute and dinghy were stowed away and required clipping onto his harness before use. In the confusion of keeping the aircraft under some kind... In the confusion of keeping the aircraft to some kind of control, I had no idea whether Bambi was wounded or managed to attach both parachute and dinghy to his harness. From our drills in the swimming pool, I was aware that he was not a very good swimmer, nor very confident in the water. All these things passed through my mind. The sea was not very rough, but was freezing cold. While it was dark, there was little I could do except shiver and wait for the dawn, which was a long time coming. With the first rays of daylight, I was able to take stock of my position. The sky and the sea were cold and grey, blending together. For the first time, I could make out the colour and shape of the dinghy, only to realise that it was floating upside down and that I'd been lying across it all night. Obviously, the first thing to do was to turn it over and get into it properly. I went into the water, and it was very, very cold. With considerable effort, I righted the dinghy and clambered over the side onto it. The dinghy itself was oblong, no more really than a rubber ring with a bottom to it, but by drawing my legs up, I could sit in it quite comfortably. The bottom held about an inch of water, and even with the quite calm sea, water constantly splashed over the side. There was very little in the way of equipment. All I could find was a bag attached by a piece of string to the dinghy, which would serve as a sea anchor or bailer, a pair of small bellows, thank goodness as the dinghy was still only half inflated, and nothing else. No rations, no water, no paddles. Either they had fallen out during the night while the dinghy was inverted, or they had never been there in the first place. I went through my pockets, but there was very little of use in them except for a knife. At this stage, the complete lack of survival aids didn't seem very important. The whole business of righting the dinghy and settling into it must have taken about an hour. My watch had stopped at 3 o'clock the previous night. So I reckon it must have been about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was now getting quite light. The sky was overcast with a cloud base of about 400 feet with very poor visibility. In the light, I could see blood mixing with the water in the bottom of the dinghy. For the first time, I realized that I was wounded. Not badly, but either shell splinters or splinters of the aeroplane caused by the shells hitting it had entered my leg. I did my best, trying a hanky around the wound, but it caused me no discomfort. I estimated I must be within about 20 miles of the Cherbourg Peninsula and 100 miles out from England. I'd been in contact with one of our aircraft before bailing out and had surely transmitted enough for someone to get a fix on my position. So there should be a reasonable hope of being picked up. So I sat shivering, thinking of a hot bath and a steaming cup of coffee. Then I heard the wonderful throb of aircraft engines in the distance, getting closer, and suddenly I saw them, two single-engine aircraft heading towards me. What were they, Spitfires or Messerschmitts? I was so cold I didn't really care, although I crossed my mind that if they were Germans they might shoot me up. At any rate, I waved like mad. The two aircraft turned slightly away, and my heart sank, thinking they had missed me in the poor visibility. But no, they suddenly wheeled around and dived in my direction. Here it comes, I thought, and I closed my eyes. No machine guns. I looked up as they swept overhead. Spitfires. They circled around and dived again. This time something fell from one of them and burst into smoke as it hit the sea. I paddled over with my hands to find it was only a smoke flare. But again, this did not worry me. Everything was going fine, and in no time, a boat would be out to pick me up. The Spitfire circled low overhead once more, and then skimmed low over the sea, off into the mist. I listened to their engines dying away into the distance, and relaxed as much as one can after a night in the water, waiting for the expected boat. My spirits were high as I waited throughout the morning, confident of being picked up. The early arrival of the Spitfires gave me a pleasant feeling of security. The weather improved a little, and for a short time the sun even shone dimly through the overcast and mist. But the hours wore on, with no sign of rescue, and I made dozens of excuses for the delay. I became worried, not desperate. Every minute expecting the noise of a boat approaching. I was very hungry, but not thirsty. It was impossible to reeve myself over the side of the boat, so I lowered my trousers and had my morning constitutional in the bottom of the dinghy. As midday approached, I became increasingly resentful towards both the Spitfires and the SE rescue boats for taking so long. My dinghy became caught in a tidal race, and I was swept along like a cork in a current. I knew every minute was taking me further and further away from the position where the Spitfires had found me. The tidal race must have taken me near land, as I could just make out the blur of a coastline on the horizon. The relief of seeing what could be a sanctuary was too much, and I slipped over the side of the dinghy and started to swim towards the land. I was a good swimmer, but with a May West on, it only took about 50 yards to make me realize that I might make a mile at the most, and trying to swim ashore was as good as committing suicide. I turned round and could only just make out the dinghy bobbing now, about 200 yards away. I was in a panic to get back to the only security I knew. It was an awful struggle, but I finally made it.